listener production.
Dr. Andrew Huberman is a renowned neuroscientist and associate professor of neurobiology and behavioral sciences at Stanford University and host of the Huberman Lab podcast.
If you don't know who Andrew Huberman is, that won't be the case for long.
I'm Andrew Huberman, and I'm a professor of neurobiology and ophthalmology at Stanford School of Medicine.
I have two sons. They are obsessed.
Most men in the country are. He's become like this go-to guy.
He has so many impressive things about him as a scientist.
When we think of science, we think of this man, last year featuring on the cover of Time magazine under the heading How Andrew Huberman Got Americans to Care About Science. My conversation with Andrew traverses many realms. We cover the profound impact of sunlight exposure on mental health and longevity, along with ways to stop grey hairs from forming, strategies for managing blue light exposure, and ways in which to maintain skin elasticity and collagen as we age. I also ask him the question, are all those skin creams we are using actually doing anything to prevent wrinkles?
There is some evidence that consumption of high-quality collagen supplements can make a minor, I really want to highlight this, a minor improvement in certain things like elasticity of skin. Things to promote healthy skin should always be of the, I think, the sort of foundational things, sleep, microbiome. Maybe there's a case, you know, use case for collagen if someone has the disposable income and they kind of want that edge. Avoiding excessive sun exposure, avoiding excessive stress. We know that the graying of hair is in part just age dependent and in part is controlled by stress. We now know that.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Through my years of studying and researching the connection between human behavior, personal growth, and transformation, I have discovered the keys to unlocking greatness within others. In this podcast, I share stories and experiences from my own teachings, along with conversations with inspiring guests to help you learn the simple tips, habits, practices, and strategies to cultivate an extraordinary existence. In 2021, Dr. Huberman launched the Huberman Lab podcast, which is one of the most popular podcasts in the world. This interview is special as Andrew barely does podcast interviews and I got to be face-to-face with him in Sydney whilst recording it. I've interviewed hundreds of guests before and I have to say, this was an interview I was so excited about. Andrew is kind, full of deep wisdom, and honestly, I could have talked to him for 3 hours more. My hope is that this exchange provides you with invaluable insights for achieving optimal health, radiant vitality, and lasting mental well-being. Andrew, Time magazine last year printed an edition with you on the cover that said, How Andrew Huberman Got America to Care About Science. As a child, how did your love of science come about?
So as long as I can remember, I've loved animals and nature and biology. My father also happens to be a scientist. He's a physicist.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of discussion of science and scientists in my home. And my mother is a writer, but has a deep appreciation for the natural world. So I was sort of immersed in it from an early age. And I love and loved animals of all kinds, including the human animal. So I would pass many hours as a young kid in aquarium stores, reading about fish, reading about different mammals. I was less interested, frankly, in extinct animals like dinosaurs and fantasy animals like dragons that I think a lot of young children are exposed to and interested in. And I was very interested in extant animals. And I delighted and I still delight in kind of their specializations. So I loved the platypus, which is very relevant to folks down here. We don't have them in the States, but you have them down here because of their unusual combination of features, webbed feet, but mammalian, but electric sensing bill. I found it incredible. And so I found the diversity of animals incredible. And from a young age, I was supported in learning and thinking about science and the natural world. So my parents didn't get in my way on that. I really can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in learning about live things. I was less interested in plants, although I love plants, but I found that animals and their unique abilities and humans to be super interesting. And so much so that I would pass a lot of my time reading the encyclopedia, reading the Guinness Book of World Records, anything and all things about animals. I wanted to own all of them, of course. I was highly disappointed I couldn't. And even though my dad was a scientist, we didn't spend that much time talking about physics. But there was one story that a very brief story, I promise, that comes to mind where my dad, when I was about 6 years old, used to walk me to school. I would go about halfway and then I would pick up another student, a young woman who lived across the street, she was a 6-year-old girl. And we would walk to the rest of the way to the cul-de-sac where the school was at the end of my street. And one day I was walking with my dad and he would hang a left into this little pathway to his laboratory.
Yeah.
He would walk to work. And I asked him, you know, what do you do for work? And he started to sort of explain. And then I said, and I'll never forget this. I said, you know, does it feel good? And he said, interesting. He said, yes, it's kind of like the feeling of the night before your birthday every single day. And I thought, well, that sounds great. And I have to credit him. I mean, what a great way to intrigue a child about a possible career path. And I said, well, then I want to do what you do. I want to be a physicist. And he said, no, I don't think you want to be a physicist because most of the great problems in physics are already worked out. You probably want to work on something where there are bit more new information, more low-hanging fruit, if you will. And I said, well, what don't we know much about? And he said, well, we don't know a lot about the brain. So this would have been 1981. I was born in 75. And I said, well, then I'll study the brain. And so there was a path set in that discussion. We both remember that discussion.
Wow.
But then, of course, by the time I got to be 13, I hit puberty. There were a number of family challenges, a very unfortunately high conflict divorce, a lot of moving, a lot of chaos, frankly, that took me out of any kind of academic track or learning from about the age of 13 until the age of 19, when through a set of trials and tribulations, I did eventually make my way to university. And then it was in my second year of university that I reconnected with that love of learning science. And at that point, it was more or less survival because I had spent so many years not really functioning well in the classroom setting. But once I got back to that love of learning and I had a few excellent teachers, I was just like gas pedal all the way, learn, read, talk about it all the time. I knew I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to be a professor. I wanted to have a laboratory. Mm. And so the childhood seed of it, there was a hiatus there, an important hiatus, but a challenging one. And then then it's just been since 19, I'm 48 now, and that's pretty much all I do.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it, when we have, I suppose, like a dream as such when we're young, like this is like we know that that's what you want to be. Like from the age of 4, I just knew I wanted to work in entertainment. I just knew it. I watched The Wizard of Oz and it was like it was sold for me. I just wanted to work in entertainment. And like you, I kind of did a roundabout, worked in marketing and PR and all this kind of jazz, but I always knew that my home was somewhere to do with entertainment and I loved talking to people and it kind of formed naturally, but now it's like, you know, you wouldn't look back. Like every day I come and I do this job and it's the most nourishing thing I think I could do with myself. But I wonder for people that have children, how do we allow them to keep that dream alive? I think so much of society tries to say like, oh, no, you can't do that. And I mean, you know, being a scientist and doing that kind of work is looked upon as being very high cred. But I think there's something in that that we should allow our kids to be able to dream big because when they do, it's like the rest of their life is completely different. They're doing stuff that they love. And we see so many people these days who are just in jobs that they just do not like. And then that we see the rates of depression and all that kind of stuff.
The spark, like that early feeling of delight in something that happens before we're thinking practically about income or whether or not a particular job is considered an attractive job or an unattractive job. That's an important thing. And I think it's the feeling. It's the energy that's created in us when we think about certain things and that we first come into contact with when we're young, before we have all these filters up of judgment and what others are going to think. That's really critical. You know, I think that being a scientist is considered a fairly respected profession by most. To be honest, it's not a lucrative profession. Scientists are often, I wouldn't say they struggle financially, but it's not a lucrative profession. It's not like law, business, or medicine.
Yeah.
It is really a sort of craft of deep love and desire to answer questions, to remain curious. And of course, there are exceptions to that. You have these, you know, high-flying scientists that are patenting everything and, you know, everything from drugs to devices and set, you know, so it can be profitable for some people. But what we consider the quote-unquote card-carrying scientist is somebody that loves asking questions, that is willing to remain curious. And I define curiosity as a deep interest in knowing the answer without an attachment to what the answer is. I think it was Dorothy Parker who said, the cure to boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity, which I love. I've always been curious about how things work, how we work, how other animals work. And that was the spark for me. Mm. You know, I think if a child is exposed to a great number of different options and they are allowed to sort through that buffet, if you will, sensing their own energy about what they like and don't like, then one is in the best position to find those things. And I think for adults that are perhaps in a job they don't enjoy or a career track that doesn't feel right for them, I think if we spend a little bit of time thinking back to the things that we enjoyed when we were younger, before these filters come up around expectation, et cetera, that what we're looking for is not, okay, when I was a kid, I used to like to build sandcastles. Maybe I want to build sandcastles, but it's more about, well, what is it? Is it about creating little miniature landscapes of real life? You know, it takes some introspection. Mm. So it's hard to apply kind of an across the board set of questions that if one you ask these 10 questions, you'll find what your purpose. I don't think it works that way. I think that people have to sense into their own energetics, meaning their own, what gives them energy as opposed to what drains them. And even if we can't do those things as professionals and get paid for it, that there's great benefit to accessing those energy states as an adult. And you see this over and over in the realm of art, music, science, certainly medicine, that when somebody is well aligned with their career path, it's just a beautiful thing and only good things can happen. Yeah. And when we're not aligned with that, even in subtle ways, it really can drain our mental health. I've actually had the experience and the opportunity, for instance, of I was offered a very, frankly, lucrative job in biotech. Mm. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting choice. Many faculty members in the university go to biotech. The Bay Area where I live is full of biotech companies. And the mission of this biotech company was quite noble. But for me, the idea of being in a cubicle and talking about the results of clinical trials and sort of talking to lawyers about patents, like it lands me somewhere between wanting to take a nap and getting hives. Now it's science, quote unquote. It's not that I don't think it's interesting. It's just not for me. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the key things for anyone thinking about career or hobby or expanding on this notion of purpose is to imagine the daily life in that particular endeavor. This was one of the best pieces of advice I ever got when I was considering changing universities is you think about the name of the university, you think about who your colleagues are going to be, you think about, sure, the salary, the benefits, because you have to be practical. But also think about, like, take oneself through a typical Wednesday at that place. What does it feel like to drive there? How's the parking? What does it feel like to go into the building? And in doing that, sensing into how it feels can inform a lot about whether or not it's the right choice or the wrong choice. And then the hard part is making that choice and trying to discard all those judgments like, oh, well, that's the better university. You know, several times in my career, I've left or moved from universities that were considered by everybody, the rankings and everybody, to be of higher, quote unquote, ranking for a slightly lower ranking university. But I did it because of a draw towards a particular set of people or circumstances. And in every single case, my productivity went up dramatically when following these kind of energetics. I may have a problem in that I can't stay in the wrong professional situation too long. And I feel like I'm almost drawn to certain professional situations that are right for me. Like, I never anticipate having a podcast, but at the end of 2020, Lex Friedman, who has a wonderful science and technology and culture podcast, made the suggestion to start a podcast. And within 3 weeks, we were buying cameras and setting something up. I sold my home. I moved to a rental. We set up, my producer, Rob Moore, and I set up in a closet and brought my bulldog with me, a 16-year-old kid who was an intern with me. And we released our first episode about a month later. And that was the first episode of the Huberman Lab podcast. So I have an almost compulsion towards what's right.
Yeah.
But it took a long time and I made a lot of errors along the way of wrong turns, having to leave circumstances, and that was all uncomfortable. But I think for me, I just can't stay in the wrong professional situation. And I acknowledge that there are always practical constraints. Mm. One can't always do that. And at times it was scary. It was like, I remember my father, who's a scientist, saying when I was leaving a university voluntarily for what was considered a lower, quote unquote, lower caliber university. And he said, how many people are in the graduate class? And I said, two. And he said, you're kidding me. And he said, well, either you're making the best decision of your life or you're destroying it all. And I thought, oh, well, no pressure. But in the end, when I, 4 years later, we finished with, you know, some great work done that I truly enjoyed.
Yeah.
And at that point, I think he was like, okay. And same thing with the podcast. I love my dad, but when I started the podcast, he's like, well, I don't know. How are people going to view this? You're doing this public facing stuff. And, you know, and then within 6 months, he's like, well, I guess it was the right thing. So, you have to be willing to, yeah. You have to be willing to take the risk and fail. And, you know, but there it is.
Yeah. My dad is a doctor and he says the same thing when I started this podcast. He's like, so do you make money? From mm-hmm. podcasts,
yeah, very practical.
Sarah, do you yeah. make money? Mm-hmm.
I think because no parent wants yes, to see their child stricken or dependent. But the takeaway that I think I'm realizing right now is whatever brings out the best and greatest amount of energy.
Yes.
And when we're talking about energy, we're talking about neural energy that it clearly relates to things like dopamine and norepinephrine, the things that get us into an activation state that we have to have that because money, of course, is necessary for living. I always say, yes, money can't buy happiness, or I guess it should be no, money can't buy happiness, but money absolutely buffers against stress.
Yes.
To be honest,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
So anyone who says differently probably has a lot of money. Mm. And so one needs to be practical, but if one zooms out, you realize that the most practical thing is to do the thing that gives you the most energy. Provided it's benevolent and it contributes to society and your own sense of well-being, well, that's the thing that you're going to be able to do at the highest level, as opposed to something else that, you know, makes you feel like you'd want to take a nap or gives you hives.
Yeah.
There's just no way I could be successful in biotech. No way.
Yeah.
For more than a year, I'd probably end up physically sick.
Yes, well, that's the thing. Obviously, a lot of what you talk about is on a range of different scientific matters, but something that has been a love of yours and has educated a lot of people that I'd like to talk about is the importance of sunlight and especially the morning sun. And obviously, you've been in Australia for a couple of weeks now, and our sun it's got a bite to it, as I'm sure you've experienced.
It does have a bite. Yeah.
So compared to other places in the world, like you don't have to be out there for very long to be able to get burnt and this and that. But a lot of Aussies, we've all had like slip, slop, slap, which is the slogan about like putting a lot of sunscreen on and a lot about skin cancer and things like that. And there's a lot of research that talks to different things to do with sunscreen, to do with when you should be out getting sun. I'd love to know your views on that, on sunscreen.
Great.
Especially being in Australia as well.
Yeah. Well, first off, I do consider light and sunlight in particular to be one of the six key pillars of mental health and
yes.
physical health. The others just very quickly are sleep, nutrition, exercise/movement, right? Relationships, including relationship to self, social interactions and relationship to self are so key. Stress control, or having some means to regulate stress because stress is inevitable. And then light, and in particular sunlight, for a variety of reasons. We know that regular exposure to sunlight to the eyes, and I'll explain what I mean by regular, is essential for setting our so-called circadian rhythm, that is regular sleep-wake cycles, and that is absolutely essential for mental health. There's a beautiful study out of the UK that was published recently with over 86,000 subjects showing that the positive effects of getting sunlight, especially early in the day, on all aspects of mental health, in addition to suppressing certain symptoms of mental illness, because we don't want to confuse mental health and mental illness, and this is really key, getting dark exposure at night, right? We rarely think about the absence of light as a positive, but being in the dark or very dim light at night is absolutely essential for mental health. Essentially, more sunlight early in the day, provided one doesn't burn. We'll talk about burning and sunscreen, et cetera. or damage one's eyes, is great for mental health. The data show that. Everything from PTSD, depression, et cetera, the symptoms get better. They might not be cured, but get better when people are getting sunlight during the day, especially the morning, and in darkness at night. And if you think about what most people are doing nowadays, they don't tend to get enough sunlight during the morning. Then they go into environments where they're under artificial lights, thinking those lights are very bright, but they're actually far dimmer, far less photon energy than were they to just get a little bit of sunlight outside. And then at night, people are exposed to those same artificial lights and screens. But here's the diabolical thing. The neural retina, the portion of the eye that responds to light, it's actually a part of the brain that lines the back of your eye, is more sensitive to light at night, so it takes very little artificial light to disrupt these circadian rhythms, blood glucose regulation, et cetera. We can get into that more. So one of the six pillars of mental health, physical health, and performance is light and sunlight in particular, because we know from now hundreds of studies on humans that if humans get a little bit of sunlight in their eyes early in the day, when the sun is at what's called low solar angle, a couple of things are key. First of all, it sets in motion the circadian rhythm for elevated daytime mood, focus, and alertness and enhanced immune system function. And it sets a timer on when one goes to sleep at night. So it's among the most important things that we can do. Now, on overcast days, it's especially important. And this is usually the portion of the conversation where a listener thinks, there's no sunlight where I live. Okay, I'm going to tell you, unless you live underground, there is always sunlight. There's always sunlight. And if you look at how bright it is on the worst stormy overcast day versus at night, guess what? It's a lot brighter outside. Mm. There's always sunlight. Now, when we say sunlight, people think the sun, the object, like you need to go see the sun, the object, but that's not the case. You need sunlight. You need the photon energy coming down through the sky, especially on cloudy days. I always say about 5 minutes to 10 minutes on a clear day, about 10 to 20 minutes on a partially overcast day, and as much as 30 minutes on an overcast day. Ideally, you get outside. You don't do this through a window. You don't wear sunglasses for this, provided you can do that safely. Contacts and corrective lenses, eyeglasses are fine. You face in the direction of the sun. If you're in the shade, it's not a big deal. But if you can get some sunlight in your eyes, provided that you blink to protect your eyes, you'll know when you need to blink because you don't want to stare at the sun. But I have to put all these caveats. Yeah. Now, what does that do? What that does is it triggers the activation of a set of neurons in the eye called the intrinsically photosensitive melanopsin ganglion cells, which is just a bunch of science speak for the neurons that then communicate to an area of your brain called the hypothalamus, which then releases all these hormones and peptides into your system all day long and sets your melatonin rhythm for nighttime sleep. It is the most powerful stimulus for all of that stuff. No supplement, no food, no social engagement, no caffeine, no nothing can do all of that, as well as morning sunlight exposure. Now, if you miss a day, no big deal. But when do you do it? Well, when the sun is low in the sky, it has a couple of features that are really important. First of all, you'll notice on a clear day that there's a lot of yellow and kind of pink blue contrast when the sun is low in the sky, as opposed to when it's directly overhead, you just kind of see this bright white light. Those color contrasts are the best stimulus for those cells in the back of the eye to do their thing. The other thing about low solar angle sunlight in the morning and the evening is that the UV index is very low. When the sun is low in the sky, you have very little risk of damaging your cornea, damaging your skin through sunburn. Just look at the sun early in the day and it's easier to look at for longer than when it's overhead. And there's a reason for that. There's some atmospheric interference when it's low in the sky, but also, as you catch that morning first light and the sun rising, that is the primordial stimulus for waking up our system. Now, people always say, oh goodness, you're telling me I have to watch the sunrise? No, low solar angle means anytime before it's overhead. Mm. Now, if you're a teenager and you're waking up at 11 a.m., sun's already overhead, okay, you know, you try and get a little sunlight in your eyes. But here's the deal. Getting those minutes of sunlight exposure to the eyes is oh so important for mental health and physical health. And again, sets in motion all sorts of positive things. But then people say, well, what about sunburn? Mm. Okay, well, the best way to avoid sunburn is to avoid bright sunlight exposure when the sun is directly overhead, sort of in the middle of the day. And by the way, getting sunlight exposure to your eyes in the middle of the day, while it can have some benefits on mood and hormone production by way of exposure to the skin, we'll talk about what's too much, what's too little, your circadian rhythm, that is these mechanisms controlling sleep wakefulness, cannot be impacted by light during the middle of the day. It's called literally the circadian dead zone. You can't shift your circadian clock then, but morning sunlight is key and afternoon sunlight is key as well. Again, when the sun is lowering, you don't have to see it just sink behind the horizon. If you can, great. But if you don't, no big deal. Now, what about sunburn and what about sunscreen? I confess, I want to just highlight this because on some previous discussions of this topic, I've had elements clipped out and I've been misunderstood as thinking that sunscreen is not good for us or maybe even bad for us. And I want to go on record. This is a wonderful opportunity to say, there is definitely a case for sunscreen. Mm-hmm. You do not want skin cancer. You do not want to burn. And the UV index is very high here in Australia. And as you pointed out, it has a bite to it. The sun has a bite. So I use sunscreen. I will repeat, I use sunscreen. I do focus on using sunscreens that are basically where the only active ingredient is zinc oxide. Mm. Because the zinc oxide sunscreens, and by the way, I have no relationship to any sunscreen brand. I just happen to do that because most of the sunscreens that do have things in addition to zinc oxide, not all of them, but many of them, I should say, not most, many of them include things that are known to go transdermally through the skin and that there are studies have shown that they may have some potential negative effects on other organs and systems of the body. And so given that there are excellent mineral-based sunscreens, I prefer to use those. Now, regardless of what type of sunscreen one feels safe using or not, I think it's worth mentioning that the best thing to prevent sunburn is a physical barrier, a long sleeve shirt that's kind of loose. This is known all over the world, especially in desert cultures, like a hat, right? A brimmed hat, if you will. It's fine to combine that with sunscreen if you need it, but one of the best ways to keep from burning is to not let the sun reach your skin. Right, through a physical barrier. And there's no debate about whether or not the physical barrier causes, you know, potential ill effects of, you know, there are some sunscreens with some nasty stuff in them. Now, how nasty and, you know, whether or not it impacts things like fertility or whether or not they're pro-cancerous has been debated quite a bit. I'm of the mind that if one can make a better, clearly safe choice, why risk the potentially unsafe choice? Right? Especially given that the costs on these things tend to be pretty much equal.
Yeah.
And given that a physical barrier is zero cost, except you need the article of clothing, well, then that makes sense. Now, so I wear sunscreen, especially in the middle of the day. Here, I've been slathering it on.
Yeah.
I do think that it's worth noting that we do have a natural adaptation to sun exposure, which is the addition of some melanin to the skin, right? The melanocytes, the cells that cause some pigmentation, can either turn on or migrate when we get some sun exposure to the skin. And there's a very close relationship between sun exposure to the skin and the production of hormones like testosterone, estrogen, and dopamine, which is a neuromodulator. There's a brief anecdote in the landscape of natural biology that's relevant here. There are certain animals like the Arctic fox and other animals like that that are, no surprise, they're white in the winter and they happen to be darker in the summertime. So pelage color changes in certain animals by virtue of those same melanocytes being activated or suppressed in the presence or absence of the sun. We don't have hair. We have little hairs on us. They're remnants of when we were probably much hairier organisms. But when we get sunlight on our skin, there's the production of dopamine. Now, why would we say, okay, how dopamine and pelage color and all this? Well, it turns out that the same gene pathway, there's an enzyme called tyrosinase. Tyrosinase, anytime you hear ASE, you're talking about an enzyme. The tyrosinase pathway is the pathway that's mutated in the albino mutation. In other words, the same pathways that control pigmentation of the skin and of pelage in animals that have fur is related to dopamine. Why? Tyrosine is the precursor to dopamine. So I'm throwing out a bunch of things here, but here's the takeaway. Getting a bit, not too much, but a bit of sun exposure to the skin in the middle of the day is known to elevate levels of dopamine. And dopamine is a neuromodulator. You can feel it. And it's known to elevate testosterone and estrogen in humans. And when people say, here, elevate testosterone and estrogen, usually what happens is all the women worry, well, I don't want my testosterone too high. But guess what? In women, the levels of testosterone per deciliter are higher than levels of estrogen. They just so happen to be, on average, lower than the absolute levels of testosterone in men. So men and women both need testosterone and estrogen to, quote unquote, feel good, to feel vigorous. And when this was a beautiful study published in Cell Reports Medicine last year or the year before, perhaps, it was a study done in the Middle East where they had people go outside for about 30 minutes in the kind of late afternoon when the sun was going down, so not going to burn you too badly, or in the early afternoon, and make sure that people got that sun exposure onto their skin wearing shorts and a tank top or so. And what they found is that it significantly elevated levels of those hormones and feelings of well-being, something that we've known forever. You probably didn't even need the study, but now that the study's published, we can look to that. And the feelings of well-being associated with getting some regular sunlight exposure are related to this activation of this tyrosinase pathway and the release of dopamine, which again is a neuromodulator involved in many things, not just mood. But generally, when we have a little bit higher circulating dopamine, or release of dopamine in the brain, we feel more positive anticipation. We enjoy things more. We have more energy. It's part of a small group of molecules called the catecholamines, which is dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. Those three act as a kind of cocktail in our brain and body to make us feel like we have energy. And in the winter months, when we're not getting as much sunlight, especially when we're not viewing morning sunlight, we're getting less sunlight down to our skin. That's why in certain locations on the earth, people feel malaise. They feel less excited about life. Dopamine levels are lower, which makes perfect sense given that sunlight is activating the pathways that trigger dopamine synthesis. So that's a lot of biology. It's kind of a chapter of biology kind of stuffed into one rambling sentence. But when you look at the mechanisms of these things, you start to realize, like, sunlight's great for us, but not too much.
Yeah.
And the timing of sunlight really matters. And artificial light, while wonderful, I mean, we all rely on it, it's a good idea to dim the lights at night. It's a good idea to turn off the phone when you go to sleep. It's a good idea to look at most artificial light in the same way that you would view nutrition and calories. You're not just interested in getting enough calories. You want nutritious calories, right? That's really, I think, what we've come to conclude these days, whether or not you're vegan or vegetarian, omnivore or whatever. Artificial lights are mostly blue light, short wavelength light. Sunlight is full spectrum. It has reds, it has oranges, it has pinks. Even on overcast days, it has all that stuff. Even though you can't see it, it's coming through. So artificial lights, I look at as a bit of like empty calorie light. It doesn't do much for you. It's not great for you. It's not necessarily bad, but getting a lot of that without getting enough full spectrum light is why I believe a lot of people are experiencing malaise. I think a lot of the mental health issues that we observe nowadays in kids and adults are not just related to the content of what they're looking at. It's related to the illumination format, the you know, being in a screen all day, being in under artificial lights all day, not getting outside enough. And as a final incentive for getting outside a bit, not too much each day, there's some beautiful studies looking at myopia, nearsightedness, and the fact that kids and adults who get outside, even if they're on their laptop or tablet or phone for 2 hours a day or more, again, you can be in the shade, don't get burned. I'm not suggesting anyone bake themselves in the sun for 2 hours a day or more, are offsetting the development, in some cases, partially reversing the offset, partially reversing the effects of looking at things too close and being indoors, which is myopia, nearsightedness. So there's so many incentives for getting outside a bit, but yes, avoid getting a sunburn. And sunscreen is one way to do it. Physical barrier is another. And if you want to know what's enough light, keep in mind that all of these systems I'm talking about, they're slow integrating systems. So if you get out on the weekend quite a bit more, Monday and Tuesday, you're probably fine.
Yeah.
Wednesday, you're probably fine. But then, you know, try and take a walk in midday, take your lunch outside, get out onto a balcony midday. You know, if you spend 5 days indoors, you'll really notice the negative effects. And if you've been doing that and you feel lousy, there could be any number of reasons, but lack of adequate sunlight might be one of them. Too much sunlight is the amount that burns you or gives you skin cancer. And people differ in terms of what that level of exposure is. So I can't sit here and say 2 hours a day. You need to be able to really gauge what's safe for you. But, you know, if you're avoiding sunlight like the plague, that's not good either.
Do you think sunglasses have a place, or they're more of a fashion item?
Sunglasses have their place. I have very sensitive eyes. We all, you know, vary in terms of how much we can tolerate bright light of any kind. I need sunglasses during the middle of the day to drive, in some cases to be out. For the morning sunlight viewing, I don't think you need it. But if you feel you do, maybe you have just very sensitive eyes. I think they definitely have their place. And I use them for safety reasons. I use them when I'm out. But if you're constantly in dark sunglasses and then you're going in and to artificial lights indoors. And then in the evening, you're watching Netflix or you're on your computer tablet. You're basically doing everything in reverse. And what's interesting is, you know, we hear about jet lag. We hear about shift work. We've known for decades that shift workers have an immense number of different serious problems with mental health and physical health. It's just, and thank goodness for shift workers. They're very beneficial to society. We need them. And so thank you, shift workers. But here's what's interesting. Almost everybody nowadays, including our young children, qualify as shift workers based on the definition of shift work, which is doing work or cognitive engaging stuff for 3 hours or more past sundown. That's shift work. You're working into the evening. And I'm not one to think, okay, we need to go back to our cave dwelling ways, but I think we just need to be aware of what we're doing ourselves. And these studies that I mentioned earlier out of the UK really speak to the key importance of light during the day and darkness at night, not pitch black at night and glaring sunlight burning your skin during the day. That's not what we're talking about. But in moderation, these things can be very, very helpful.
For people that are going through midlife, both women and men, what do you recommend for improving skin elasticity, collagen, food, supplements? Because a lot of people, when they start going through that time in their life, it can be really hard. I mean, they can do a lot of exercise, you know, that builds muscle, but it's not changing the skin elasticity that much. I'd love you to talk to that.
Yeah. So aging and offsetting the effects of aging is a multifactorial thing, of course. And I'll just, you know, always go back to those six pillars. If you're not sleeping enough, and what is enough? Enough is the amount that allows you to feel rested during the day, except for perhaps the need for a brief 10 to 90 minute nap. Some people don't like naps, some people do. You know, a lot of people say, I have insomnia. Insomnia is defined as excessive daytime sleepiness. Excessive daytime sleepiness. Not getting a great night's sleep is not insomnia. But getting your sleep right, and we've done many episodes of the Huberman Lab podcast on this. We have a series coming out with Matt Walker, who wrote the book Why We Sleep later this year. Getting your sleep right is key. And again, nutrition, movement, controlling stress, relationships, sunlight, all essential to slowing the aging process. And there are, gosh, hundreds of thousands of studies to support that. Now, with respect to skin specifically, I think there are a couple of things that are a little less known that I think are particularly powerful. So I'll mention those first.
Yeah, great.
The first is keeping the gut microbiome healthy. It's now clear that the trillions of little microbiota that live in our gut everywhere, you know, all the way along our gut, are essential for the production of little fatty acids, which sound bad. Anytime people hear fat, they go, I don't want fat. But you know, that fatty acids are great that then provide the substrate for creating neuromodulators, neurotransmitters like dopamine, serotonin, acetylcholine, et cetera. And those neuromodulators are absolutely essential for cognitive function, maintaining brain health. In addition, the gut microbiome is but one of the many microbiomes that we have on us and in us. And one of the primary microbiomes, and this is rarely discussed, but hopefully this will be an opportunity for that, is the skin microbiome. Many of the microbiota that, I know it's weird to think about trillions of things living on our skin, actually provide a barrier to bacteria and viruses that are constantly trying to bombard us, get into our system. The skin microbiome is supported by healthy gut microbiota. And the best way to support all of these microbiome niches on the skin, in the gut, on the surface of the eyes, even in the urethra, et cetera, is clearly through the consumption of enough fiber and both prebiotic and probiotic fiber. So fruits and veggies kind of thing, but also to make sure that you're getting at least some servings of low sugar fermented foods now and again. So this could be kefir, yogurt, again, low sugar, sauerkraut, kimchi, natto, you know, different cultures have these things. People always say beer, you know, okay, yes, beer, but maybe not the best source given the negative effects of alcohol and the excess in calories and sugar, which frankly don't contribute anything to nutrition, et cetera. But it's very clear from work by my colleague, Justin Sonnenberg at Stanford School of Medicine and others that a regular consumption of these low sugar fermented foods, 1 to 4 servings per day. So find one that you like and just try and have a couple spoonfuls of sauerkraut or kimchi or have a pickle or something. And it has to be the stuff that needs to be refrigerated, the briny taste, that salty taste. The gut microbiome loves that. And the skin microbiome benefits when the gut microbiome is healthy, and the skin microbiome in particular benefits when you're not killing it off with things like, I hate to say this because we need chlorine in pools, the public pools, but things like chlorine killing the microbiome, that's why it's in the water, right? Because they're trying to kill off all the bugs. So does it mean like I don't use hand sanitizer? No, of course not. I'll use some hand sanitizer. But trying to take good care of one's skin through not using harsh astringents, this kind of thing, all of that gut microbiome stuff, I spent the last 5 minutes talking about it because that's providing the milieu, the environment for the skin microbiome and the skin to flourish. Then there's the stuff from the inside. Like, what are you doing from the inside? Well, everyone knows if you're not getting enough sleep, the skin suffers. The bags under the eyes being the least of it, the skin suffers. You'll notice if you have a cut, it'll heal more slowly.
Yeah.
Many people get acne when they're not sleeping enough. And that's because of the intrusion of late evening cortisol, a hormone that's very valuable and very beneficial that we all manufacture and release early in the day. It's great to have released early in the day, but late release of cortisol in our system due to stress, due to excessive consumption of caffeine in the afternoon and evening. I hate to say it, but consumption of alcohol before sleep, you're not getting into deep rapid eye movement sleep. Cortisol levels end up higher throughout the night. And as a consequence, many people experience sometimes skin blemishes, but the whole process of repairing the skin every night, which happens every single night, the dermis and the epidermis is occurring during a specific phase of sleep, the first 4 hours of sleep. And we all know the experience of not getting enough sleep and someone just looks depleted.
Yes.
The pallor of their skin changes. We can see it when somebody's not rested. We see it in the lack of kind of brightness in their eyes. And these are all kind of peripheral signals of not getting enough sleep. So get your sleep right, get your microbiome right. And that can take some work, but it's something that will, those are things that will benefit everything. And then we get to the sort of collagen question. It's always the collagen. Yes, collagen is the critical component of skin. There is some evidence that consumption of high quality collagen supplements can make a minor, I really want to highlight this, a minor improvement in certain things like elasticity of skin, in wound repair. There's also evidence that red light, you know, these like nowadays is very popular, that red light and near infrared light can accelerate, say healing from acne, can improve some metrics of skin, quote unquote, quality. These aren't metrics that are, you know, really easy to classify, but none of those even come close to the essential benefits of sleep and microbiome support that other studies support for skin. Now, in addition to that, you know, as long as we're here, we can talk about the somewhat more adventurous and esoteric stuff. Like nowadays, there's a lot of enthusiasm about peptides. Everyone's into peptides. I can tell you where I live in California, there's a lot of peptide use, right? Some of these are serums that people put on the skin. Some of them are injectable things like BPC-157, which by the way, can, it seems, there aren't a lot of clinical studies, but it seems that it can help with wound healing and skin repair. But BPC-157 is essentially a synthetic mimic of what? A gut peptide.
Oh, wow.
It's long been known that certain juices within the gut are help us repair wounds. And if you ever had a cut in your mouth, you'll notice something interesting. The mouth is a bacteria-filled, moist, warm place, perfect for infections. And guess what? Things in the mouth heal fast.
So fast.
And they heal without a scar.
There are rare cases
where it scars.
Yeah.
That just should blow everyone's mind. It's like, how come a cut on the body surface heals much slower, sometimes with a scar, but in the mouth where it's all like warm and moist and there's bacteria, I just breathed in probably a trillion of bacteria right here, even though the air is clean here, it's everywhere. Why is that? How is that? Well, there are things within the saliva and within the juices of the gut, such as what BPC-157 is designed to mimic, that support constant turnover of the cells there. So there are some interesting things like BPC-157. Anything that, and I am not promoting the use of growth hormone or IGF-1 because that can promote the growth of tumors and things of that sort. But it is true that young children, teens, it's amazing, right? First of all, babies, who has better skin than babies, right? We saw a baby down on Bondi Beach, those little babies, and like just, you know, looking at you, you just want to like, their cheeks, they're like so cute, right? And they're just like, they're perfect, right? Like the kid is perfect. And God forbid if a kid or a baby gets a cut on it, like heals up as if it was never there. And their system is chock-a-block full of what? Full of IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor. growth hormone. Now, adults think, okay, I'll take IGF-1. I'll take a peptide like sermorelin or ipramorelin that would promote IGF-1. And you think, oh, is that the right idea? And then you step back and you think, let's be biologists about this. The fastest rate of aging that we ever go through is between birth and age 20. Mm. Look at somebody when they're 5 and look at them when they're 12. They are developing, but there's another word for developing. They are aging. Mm. So if you look at people who take things like growth hormone or IGF-1 or peptides that push on those pathways, yes, they feel more vigorous, but they're actually accelerating their aging. Mm. And that's underappreciated. So things to promote healthy skin should always be of the, I think, the sort of foundational things, sleep, microbiome. Maybe there's a use case for collagen if someone has the disposable income and they kind of want that edge. Avoiding excessive sun exposure, for sure. Avoiding excessive stress. We know that the graying of hair is in part just age dependent and in part is controlled by stress. Mm. We now know that, right? It's amazing. Down in the hair follicle niche, the little pocket that the hair follicle lives in, there's a stem cell that gives rise to the hair. And this is so wild. The stress pathways release noradrenaline around that niche. And what causes the graying of hair with stress is that inside of that pocket, that niche, it releases a peroxide. You know, in the 80s, you wouldn't know from the 80s, but I remember from the 80s, people were dyeing their hair, putting that in. You can bleach hair with peroxide. Your body produces certain peroxides under conditions of stress, which is why when people stress a lot, yes, their hair grays more. And the good news is when they're less stressed, and there are lots of ways to reduce stress, their hair, some degree of graying can be reversed. Now, there is, of course, an age-related graying of hair that is related to that same pathway and some other pathways. But when you start to look at like skin, hair, nails stuff, it almost always takes us back to the basics. Now, that as long as we're having fun with this, and I have no relationship to any company that makes it, but you know, there's been a lot of discussion of the NAD pathway. Mm. This is a molecule that's very present in all cells, especially early in development. It goes down across development. And there's a lot of interest nowadays. Some people get NAD infusions. Those are very painful, very expensive. You feel like you're getting stepped on by a donkey.
Oh, God.
It's uncomfortable, but then afterwards you feel good. But things like NMN, NR, these have been sold as supplements for longevity. It's still hotly debated whether or not they can extend the lifespan. My personal view is they cannot. Mm. But my own experience with NMN and NR, and that of many other people, and again, I have no financial relationship to this, is that daily consumption of NMN, which is a precursor to NAD, or NR, which is also in the NAD pathway, does seem to give one more energy, physical energy, and people do observe faster growth of hair and nails. It's a pretty well-established anecdata set, but there's been no formal clinical trials of it. So, and there's debate as to whether or not taking NMN or NR can increase certain kinds of cancers. So, you know, as soon as you get into this space, there's always the potential benefit, the potential risk. And so I just mentioned these things because you asked about supplements, but you know, I think the basics are most key. And it's kind of a disappointing answer, perhaps, like, oh, you want great skin, get great sleep. But I don't care how much NAD you're taking. If you're not sleeping well, your skin's going to suffer.
What about for especially women, all those creams that we're sold, like anti-aging for wrinkles, put this on your eyes, put this on this, the three things in the morning. Does any of that stuff actually work?
Yeah, I think we're going to do an episode on skin health. And so I'm yet to fully explore this, but I've started talking to dermatologists, especially those that specialize in cancers, but also cosmetic dermatologists. And, you know, I think there are some serums and creams and things of that sort that get into these cellular growth pathways and the elasticity of the skin layers that show some either marginal or moderate effect. Mm. So I'm not going to say that they're all complete garbage. I think some actually have their value. The problem is we just don't have a lot of clinical trials. So it depends on your stance. I'm somebody who obviously values science and clinical trials. There is also a huge, you know, population of people out there that, you know, while they're not saying I'll take anything to have younger looking skin, they're like, yeah, if it seems reasonably safe, I'll try it. I think there's some logical mechanisms to support the use of collagen, certain peptides that have been shown to improve the turnover of the cells in the dermal layers and the epidermal layers of the skin, limiting stress. And when we say stress, there's whole body stress, but then there's also stress to specific tissues. So for instance, every cell in the body has the opportunity, relies on mitochondria for energy production. And the more a cell is active, like a skin cell, which is, has a lot of turnover, or a neuron, a nerve cell, the more what are called reactive oxygen species that it creates, which is, we won't get into the chemistry of it too much, but there's a free electron that's released, and those free electrons can call these like reactive oxygen species, but then it causes damage to the cells, et cetera. So reducing reactive oxygen species is generally good. Improving mitochondrial function is generally good. How can we improve mitochondrial function in skin and make our skin more youthful or our eyes more youthful? And there, the data on red light and near infrared light is really interesting. There's studies out of the University of College London by my colleague, known him for decades, Glenn Jeffrey. He's done these studies showing that if people 40 or older view red light for a couple minutes in the morning, and this is just of a conventional light of red hue at a distance, you're not trying to, please don't get it too close to your eyes, just look at it for a couple of minutes, you can offset some of the age-related vision loss.
Wow.
Now, why would that be? Well, the photoreceptors of the eye that are responsible for converting light into electrical and chemical signals that the brain can understand use a ton of mitochondrial energy, and they build up a ton of reactive oxygen species. This red light exposure seems to help. So do you have to run out and buy a red light? Well, the answer is no. Why? Well, because sunlight is full spectrum light, and within the full spectrum is red light. So that morning sunlight exposure may, okay, this specific study hasn't been done, but it stands to reason based on the Glenn Jeffrey work in the laboratory where they expose people to artificial red light, may offset some of the age-related vision loss. Similarly, there are, you know, I would say a couple dozen or more studies on humans looking at the effects of red light and near-infrared light panels, having people be exposed to those for about 10 or 15 minutes per morning on things like hormone health and skin health, elasticity, and appearance. And those studies point to some interesting effects on improving the skin health and turnover of skin. And there's a mechanism to look to. So whereas I can't say a cream, this cream contains blank, which does blank to the cells, the full spectrum light business, the red light makes a lot of sense because you're reducing reactive oxygen species in the skin. Now, by extension, you might say, well, then just go get a lot of sunlight on the skin, but there's a threshold. Just as you don't want to stare at a red light and burn your eyes out, you don't want to get outside and get so much activation of the skin that with sunlight that you burn the skin. So, you know, the dose is in the poison. So my suggestion would be to consider the incredible effects of light on skin, eyes, circadian rhythm, and then ask yourself, you know, how willing and able am I to get this morning sunlight exposure on a regular basis? When I travel, I bring a very small red light panel that I'll use, that I'll look at in the morning if it's very overcast and I'm on a plane.
Yeah.
So that I can get that exposure because I'd like to keep my, I'm 48 years old, I'd like to keep my vision. I suppose I'm less concerned about my skin. I just try not to burn. But I understand why people are interested in and want these things. And if you're doing that, plus maybe you decide to take some collagen, you're trying to get great sleep, microbiome. I mean, I think you're doing pretty much whatever you can. The real extreme would be, you know, I know people are now traveling to Central and South America to get stem cell injections.
Oh,
everyone's
wow.
like stem cell.
Yeah.
That I do not recommend. There's just simply not enough science yet. And the key word there is yet. We just don't know. And there was a study there was a clinic in Florida that was injecting stem cells into the eyes to offset macular degeneration in some patients that were concerned about losing their vision. And sadly, all of those patients went blind.
Really?
Permanently blind, which is why the FDA in the United States has banned the use of stem cell injections for these kinds of purposes. So it took that, just that one clinic basically shut down all of stem cell clinics, legal stem cell clinics in the US for a good amount of time. And I think there is some interesting use cases for stem cells, but unfortunately, we're gonna have to wait because that one clinic just kind of rushed out ahead of everybody and it was a very tragic case. So I'm waiting with bated breath on the stem cell work, but we just have to put safety first.
I hope you enjoyed part one of my interview with Dr. Andrew Huberman. Part two is now available for you to listen to. Andrew and I discuss his favorite meditations and why they are so good for optimizing mental health, how to control your breathing to stop panic attacks and anxiety, his thoughts on the Wim Hof method, and of course, what a life of greatness is to him.
At every stage of life, different things, including challenges, but also aspirations, bring us different sense of meaning.
This chat blew my mind, so you don't want to miss part two, which is available now. If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Your Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my manifestation course and meditations, head to the shop tab at saragrimberg.com or this week's episode show notes to find a link. If you love what you heard, we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. Listener.